From Directions Magazine, this is Directions on the News for Tuesday, January 24th, 2012. Each week this podcast looks at news and trends related to all things location. This is Adina Schutzberg, Executive Editor in Somerville, Massachusetts.
And this is Joe Francica, Editor-in-Chief in Huntsville, Alabama.
It's been a big set of weeks for geotechnology in the news. Satellite imagery revealed another view of the Costa Concordia. Both Google MapMaker and OpenStreetMap made the news, and epidemiologists shared how they tracked an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease to a hospital waterfall. These stories offer some teachable moments for students and citizens, as well as those already involved in geospatial technology. We'll share what we can teach and learn from them after a word from our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by Intergraph, bringing you truly integrated GIS and image processing from a single organization. You can easily leverage GeoMedia and Urdas Imagine in unison to construct a larger, more complete geospatial picture. GeoMedia delivers powerful GIS analysis and management, enabling you to integrate your geospatial resources. Urdas Imagine incorporates industry-leading geospatial image processing, analysis, and remote sensing capabilities. To learn more, visit www.intergraph.com/geospatial and register for an upcoming webinar. Digital Globe made available satellite imagery on January 17th of the Costa Concordia shipwreck. Now, the ship had really hit back on the 13th, so these images were 4 days afterwards. And the image is of the ocean liner shown through the clouds, half submerged, off the coast of Giglio in Italy. The pictures are really quite nice, but what can we learn from them?
It was a really great image, first of all. I think it conveys the immediacy of the danger and just the enormity of the disaster. And I think it answers that basic question, how could a modern cruise ship sink? And I think the answer isn't really fully appreciated until you see the proximity of the ship to the rocks. Then you begin to answer more questions like, well, how were the passengers able to swim to shore? And I don't think you would have gotten this without seeing this type of image. So, and this image really was shown all over the mainstream media that I saw, so it wasn't limited to Digital Globe sending us the photograph. Yeah, I just think it conveys such an impression as to both the proximity to the rocks, the size of the ship, and then certainly the enormity of the problems that they were going to face.
Right, and it sort of raises that question of, is this where it went down or not? And actually, it's moved quite a bit from where it hit the
rocks.
Yeah. So it sort of starts generating those kinds of questions. What impressed me the most, and actually it was the Huffington Post that had what I consider to be the most complete write-up explaining the image, and the comments were, I just thought, hit the nail on the head. And the comments were on the order of, wow, what a big ship. Now, there's no scale on the image, and you have the coast to the island, and people are grasping the size of the ship. Why? Because there are buildings that you can see on the island. And you can start to get a sense of how big this thing really is. Because if I say to you the ship is 952 feet, do you have any idea what that means?
It really does do exactly what you say. Because you look at the size of the ship in proximity to the rocks. And as you say, there is no scale here. So how big are those buildings? How big is that ship? We knew it was a big ship, but it almost looks like it overwhelms the coastline.
Yeah. So really, for school-age students and even high school, it would be a wonderful exercise to just with that photograph, estimate the length of the ship.
Right. Right.
Do the best you can. Try, guess how big the buildings are and use that, for example. And maybe not even give them that idea. You know, how would you figure it out? And then how close is it to the coast? So it's a great scale lesson. Now, when we move over to what we can learn from it for those in our industry, there's a couple of really interesting questions that sort of bubbled up in some of the comments that I saw. One was, why is this picture black and white? Right? Which is a perfectly valid question. Hopefully those in the industry realize that panchromatic images are in fact black and white And often what you do is you merge them with color imagery to get a color image, but in fact, that's not what we were delivered. Was this the only image? Apparently, they've been snapping pictures. This was the only one that could see through the clouds. Right, that's a real kind of issue that comes up. And the other one that I think is most important for our industry right now is this image is getting all kinds of buzz right now because it really reveals a lot about this situation. But how can we leverage these kinds of images for all kinds of other situations beyond the most recent disaster?
Yeah, it's strange that kind of question comes up because it's not as if satellite imagery is unknown to certainly the mainstream media and what can be revealed. And this goes back to something I have mentioned quite a bit, which is we're getting closer and closer to needing real-time imagery, and the mainstream media loves this kind of stuff. They probably wish that it wasn't 4 days old. And, you know, what eventually will happen when the discussion progresses for commercial space, and will there be other companies stepping up to either do something of a spaceborne platform or perhaps unmanned aerial vehicles, something that will give us a more immediate picture of the situation? And who's going to do that? Is this going to be a separate company? Or are they going to have UAVs deployed all over the world for just such occasions like this where they can immediately fly over something to get this kind of perspective?
Well, let's move on to some stories that relate to Google. Now, it was learned in the past week that some Google contractors were going in and basically vandalizing OpenStreetMap. They were identified and they've been taken off the project. They're not working on that project for Google anymore. The IP addresses of the people vandalizing OSM matched the IP addresses of some other folks doing improper things with some data from a Kenyan company earlier this month. What's interesting about this for the public to understand is that when something is open, like OpenStreetMap, and pretty much anybody can go in and add or change things, they do, and they will, and they can, in fact, do harm. The other side of that coin, of course, is that if you do a lot of it, you're going to get found out. And that's exactly what happened. So one of the things that I hope the public understands is that if you beat on somebody's databases enough, they're going to notice.
I think it raises a few issues here for OpenStreetMaps and anything that perhaps is crowdsourced. And what it forced some of the organizers of OpenStreetMap to consider is that what was once unstructured or quasi-structured is forced to become structured and hierarchical in management, forcing some OpenStreetMap folks into almost a proprietary or data-restricted situation. You could hear the frustration in Steve Coase's blog post that we have posted with the show notes here about what to do and asking people in the community, how do we police this kind of vandalism? Almost cybercrime is how I would describe it. So it presents some interesting challenges for OSM.
If we look at it in the context of what we can learn, those of us in the geospatial industry, I was surprised at how many comments I saw in the Twitter sphere and elsewhere that really thought that folks from Google were doing this. And my thinking was the folks from Google would know better than anybody that they're going to get found out. And why would they? I couldn't imagine that's what was going on. And yet, in the case of the issue in Kenya, it was actually Google employees. You want to trust your competitors to do the right thing. The other thing that's really interesting is how the organizations that are harmed react. And what happened in both the situations involving Google was that there were public blog posts written that said, we are alleging that Google is doing harm to us. And that's an interesting choice, because the other choice would be to contact Google directly and say, hey, I think something's up, and not take it public. So that's an interesting question about how we interact with our competitors and those within our industry.
And those pathways probably are not really well defined in a project such as this, where things have been open for so long, and now all of a sudden this type of vandalism occurs and you have to deal with malcontents. You know, the finger pointing arises pretty quickly, and who are you going to point the finger at? Well, it's the big guy on the block, and you don't know how to get in touch with him. So this kind of situation we have to deal with a big guy on the block comes into play.
I would really hope that if somebody from OpenStreetMap called up Google and said, we think there's a problem involving vandalism. Somebody pretty high up in the food chain would answer the phone.
Yeah, yeah. I think what this also points out is that, and unfortunately, this type of action, you know, as Steve Coase mentioned, is really souring people on the entire effort and may force community-type efforts like this or other crowdsourcing efforts towards a more structured approach, almost
restricted.
A proprietary. Yeah.
Not, yeah. You keep saying we're proprietary, and I'm not sure that that's...
Well, I'm saying proprietary because it almost forces people into that type of a structure where it's much more restricted and much more policed.
Well, and that's what Google does, right? Anybody can make changes, right, for MapMaker,
yeah.
But somebody
mm-hmm.
else has to approve them.
Yeah.
And right now in OpenStreetMap, it doesn't work that way, as I understand it. Now, the other news related to Google was an announcement from Google about an agreement with the World Bank, which gives the World Bank the opportunity to make MapMaker data available to certain countries for emergency response type projects. And what we can learn from that, I think that the public and students need to understand, is if you own the data, you have the say about how it's shared. And if Google owns the data and they want to designate that the World Bank now has permission to make it available to certain countries, they can do that. It's a really interesting thing about this idea of database ownership or intellectual property ownership.
And in this case, the philanthropic effort, I think, on the case of Google and World Bank is fantastic. And the issue of ownership, I don't think comes into play as much as we would hope it might. Everybody looks at it as a community-based effort, and everybody's going to benefit by the situation. And the idea of licensing and ownership is really secondary to an underserved area. They just want to get the data. They licensing is really not really important to them at this point. And so when it comes up in conversation, people go, oh, well, you know, I wasn't aware that there was a license attached to it. So those types of questions don't often get addressed right up front.
No, and when the announcement was made, it took some time for, especially those in our industry and those who have some interest in open data, to really drill down and say, is this the best way to do this? And is this the data? And under what license it's going to be distributed? And Google hasn't really detailed that, which led me and others to ask, maybe it would have been better for World Bank to partner with OpenStreetMap, which has an open license and would make the data not just available to these specific countries for specific purposes, but more broadly to anybody who might want to help. And the World Bank could sort of be more of a champion of an open data solution as opposed to a more restricted one.
Do you think that the World Bank looked at it as if Google has the resources to more fully distribute the information? Keep it more updated than OSM would.
I think partly that, and partly the fact that the World Bank, I believe, already has a relationship
with
Google.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can't say that this is a bad thing, but you really have to start questioning: might there have been
other avenues to pursue?
Yeah. Or more than one, and see what works better. Now, I hate the idea of having to put MapMaker up against OpenStreetMap, and yet that's seems to be happening more and more.
Right.
Now, the last news story, I suspect, did not get widely distributed, which really disappoints me because it's one of these classics of why geography matters. And it relates to a paper by Thomas Haupt, who's a respiratory disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Division of Public Health. Down in Wisconsin, in 2010, because they track this data so carefully, they learned that there were 8 cases of Legionnaires' disease in a 4-week period in a very small area in Wisconsin. And that popped up on their radar, if you will. And then you had to figure out, okay, what's the source of it? How do we prevent it from happening again? And the answer is, you track down as many of the people as you can. You ask them where they had been for the 10 days before they got sick. And you piece that together. And you start tracking down more people who maybe had Legionnaires' disease or who were diagnosed later. And you find out that 6 of the people had been in the hospital in a particular hospital 10 days before they got sick, two others realized that they had gone to the hospital to pick up prescriptions, and one fellow was actually a driver, a delivery person, and he had gone in to deliver things, which he didn't remember. They had to actually go to the manifests for his deliveries to confirm that he, in fact, had been in the same place during that time, and they tracked it down to a waterfall within the hospital.
What a fantastic example of epidemiologic geography.
It's a great, it's Jon Snow.
It's Jon Snow. I know. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Right? So, you know, what a teachable moment, and what a reminder of how important geography is and where we travel, how it impacts our lives and life and death. I mean, this is a really deadly disease.
What was also interesting is the microgeography that was introduced. The fact that the pharmacy was in proximity to the waterfall, and then the explanation that they couldn't chlorinate the water because it would have smelled bad, and even though the water was changed often enough,
right. It still managed to harbor.
To breed the bacteria, yeah. But it also wouldn't have been diagnosed if they hadn't done the extensive interviews with the patients. And
right, and I think that's the key thing that the public needs to understand about this is we think we have all this data just sitting out there. An awful lot of the work in geography still is the legwork of gathering the data, doing it efficiently, doing it carefully, mapping it carefully, and then you can have this magic moment where you can go right to the source of the problem.
Yeah, it really has been amazing to see how they tracked it to the waterfall because they asked the right questions. And isn't that the crux of a lot of the investigative work that you have to do is they asked where were you, where did you go? It wasn't just, okay, I went to the hospital, but where did you go in the hospital? So it almost was a microgeographic problem. They had to know.
And it comes back to this, going back to the first topic that we discussed, it's that issue of scale. These cases popped up within a geographic area, within a county, or maybe more than one county. But then we had to, if you like, zoom in even closer to the hospital and then into the area between the waterfall and the pharmacy. It's awesome.
Right. The best thing is we begin to ask these spatial questions. We begin to think spatially about how we investigate these challenges, and whether you're at the scale of the cruise ship or whether you're at the scale of the hospital waterfall, you're really narrowing, as you said, the scale of the problem.
Yeah, and actually, if you take this news story now to the geospatial industry, the question becomes, okay, so how did these people remember where they were over the past 10 days? What tools do we have to help them remember, and how might we do this in the future? And of course, what I'm thinking about is you've got this tracking device in your pocket, this cell phone, and wouldn't it have been amazing if each of these individuals had been tracking themselves, maybe not sharing, just for their own use, and the investigator could have said, can you share with me your track, these chunk of days? And he could put them up, overlay them on top of each other, onto the map of Wisconsin and maybe even the hospital, and find out the places where they intersect.
In a building information model.
Yeah, down at the appropriate scale even. I mean, getting to the hospital is a great start. There's all kinds of opportunities here, and we in the industry have to start thinking about those in the context of studies like this. That's all the time we have for today.
This podcast is brought to you by Intergraph, provider of GeoMedia and ERDOS Imagine. GeoMedia and ERDOS Imagine feature the widest range of native data format capability on the market and a solid commitment to open standards from the OGC and ISO, providing seamless integration with current and future business systems and keeping you free from proprietary lock-in. To learn more, visit intergraph.com/geospatial.
If you'd like to comment on today's podcast, we invite you to leave a comment at Directions Magazine, where this podcast is hosted, or contact us via Twitter at Directions Mag.
And from all of us here at Directions Magazine, today starts our four-part webinar series on geospatial technologies in the real estate industry. For those of you looking for insights about all of the various entrepreneurial opportunities in real estate, this is a webinar for you. Visit our homepage at directionsmag.com for more information.
Thanks for joining us, and be sure to tell a friend.